What's up, guys? You're listening to the second annual Top 10 Movies of the Year episode here from Tony and I at Mudville. This week, we will be discussing our 10 favorite movies of 2024. If you can remember back to last year's episode, it ran almost 3 hours long. And as fun as that was, we've decided not to do that again, at least not all in one part. Our conversation the other day, as fun as it was, did run super long, so we've decided that we're going to break it up into two parts and release them over the span of the week. Today, you'll hear number 6 through 10 on each of our respective lists, as well as a brief discussion about how we approach these lists, which element of a film we weigh more heavily than others, and a glimpse into our lives as moviegoers and as regular civilians who don't have quite as much access to film festivals and early screenings as some of the critics whose best of the year lists you've likely read weeks, if not months ago. I'm proud of the conversation we had. I think you're going to enjoy it. So without further ado, I present to you Mudville's Top 10 Movies of 2024. Welcome back, everybody. It is Mudville at the Movies coming at you for a second week in a row. I am one of your hosts, Nolan Rabine.
And I'm Tony Brown.
And if you guys can remember all the way back to last week, it was our second annual Favorite Discoveries of the Year list where we talked about some of the movies that we watched for the first time in 2024. Nothing that came out last year, but movies that were new to us that we watched and took a lot of enjoyment in discovering. So we had a lot of fun last week talking about those. If you haven't heard that yet, definitely go back and do so. It was a great conversation on 20 films, probably some of which you've seen, certainly some of which you have not. This week, we're coming at you with an even bigger list. It is also our second annual episode doing this. This is the top 10 movies of 2024. This is a particularly big episode for us, and I'm really excited to get into it. But before we get into the actual list, Tony, I just want to say, I like that we've developed a tradition of doing these lists towards the end of January. I think it gives us quite a bit of time to sort of let the movies, especially that we saw towards the end of the year, sit with us, get a better sense of exactly how we put them in the context of the greater year, and gives us even more time to choose exactly what we want to highlight and what we want to discuss. I know a lot of people put their lists out sometimes even towards the start of December, so ours is like 6-7 weeks after that. You know, we're not huge film critics. We don't get paid to go to events and go to early screening. So I gotta say, I think this is the way to do it. Would you agree?
Yeah, I'd agree. You know, just a reminder that we are indeed civilians. There are many film critics out there who get passes to a lot of festivals and probably have their top 10 list more or less banged out by the end of September, because that's the end of Venice, Telluride, and of course, you know, whatever they don't get in there, they probably catch at the New York Film Festival. And then they've seen everything. They've been to every premiere, every screening, press screening, so they can get it to you by November, even December. But, you know, we're civilians. We have to sometimes wait for releases. We have to wait for releases that haven't come out yet. Films that came out in festivals in 2024, like film I'm looking forward to, Ephes, the baseball movie. Gotta see a baseball movie that got into the New York Film Festival. That's pretty cool. But we have to wait till March because I couldn't see it at the festival. I was working and it sold out. So heard great things, but it gives us time to think about things, think about films that we've seen, let things marinate, and that's what we've done here today.
It's interesting that you mentioned Ephes, and one of the more devastating things to happen to me last year, I actually had a ticket to see that at New York Film Festival, and the new Jia Zhangke film, Caught by the Tides. I had a back-to-back tickets, and I wasn't able to make either of them, and it was definitely the worst thing to happen to me as a moviegoer in 2024. I get the sense that had I seen Ephes, you know, being the host of a baseball and movies podcast, that certainly would have been on the list. But as of today, I still have not seen it. It'll probably be another like 6 weeks until it gets a wider release. But yeah, I mean, those are two films that I think had a very real chance of being on my list today had I been able to go see them. And it really just does highlight the disparity between, you know, film critics, the lists, and the timeliness in which they're able to produce them compared to, you know, guys like us. The top 10 list for the common man of people.
Wait,
who...
I will say, though, we are New York City civilians. So yeah, we you're do right. get. So there's actually, if you are not, if you are listening to this podcast and you do not live in New York City, we are definitely ahead of you, probably. The Brutalist just opened, I think, nationwide. This weekend, as we speak, I think it opened. So,
that's
you know,
correct.
I thought I was late to the game, and I saw it when I got back from the holidays. So I saw it maybe right before New Year's. So, you know, there's still some people behind us, Nolan. I feel like we're in this nice little sweet spot where we're behind the critics. We've thought about things a little longer. We spent some time tweaking, twisting our list, debating with ourselves in our minds or to anybody who would lend an ear, and we're ready to go now.
You're absolutely right. We got to put everything into context, you know, while we're not going out and seeing these movies with some of the stuffy elitist IndieWire critics out there. We're also seeing them weeks before the folks out there in rural Nebraska, so... If you're one of the common men, if you don't have festival passes, hell, if you don't even get to see wide releases until they go out nationwide, this is the podcast for you. Let me ask you this, Tony. How do you approach this list? Do you cram as much as you can into the last few months to try to see everything, to try to see especially the things that you think you're going to enjoy that might have a chance of cracking your list? Or do you just not put it out of your head entirely and see where you're at when the time comes?
You know, I do think that it depends on the year. This past year, I do try to go to festivals. And if you, listener, ever have a chance to go to a festival, whether it's in your local community or the city closest to you, you should definitely go because it's so fun. You'll never know what you'll find. There's tons of great films out there, short films, feature-length films, documentaries being made, all kinds of budgets, and you should go out and support them. So I do try to go to festivals as a civilian and put my own money on there. This year, I couldn't go to the New York Film Festival, and there's another film festival. I go to a Telluride Film Festival in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I don't know if I've brought it up on the podcast before.
I don't think you have.
So it's every September. It's the weekend after the Telluride Festival in Colorado. One of the founders of the festival retired to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, like 25 years ago or something like that. And so when he retired, he brought the festival, part of it, to Portsmouth. So the weekend after Telluride, they take 7 films from like the 50 that are in the slate on Labor Day weekend, and they bring it to Portsmouth. So I usually go because my parents live in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Oh, I shouldn't say I usually go. My parents have been more than me, but I had been the past 3 years in a row, and it's 7 movies, new releases from Telluride, which is, you know, you get some international films. Not all of them make the awards contention, but it's a nice mix of films. So I usually go to that, and I go and try and see a few at the New York Film Festival, which kind of, plus the New York City releases, I don't find myself cramming too much every year. But this year I had weddings and couldn't go, so I found myself cramming a little bit, releasing my list a little bit later than I would have liked, but you know, here we are.
Yeah, I think I've kind of done that in the past as well. Like, I've gone and I've kind of had a checklist of a bunch of movies, some of which I wasn't even really excited to watch, that just sort of felt like they were like required viewing if I was going to, you know, make a list and compare what came out to everything else. I wanted to have seen everything. But I think this year, I mean, I approached it a little bit differently. And part of that is just because there really were so many movies this year that kind of could have been in that like 7 through 10 range. And that kind of highlights, you know, how silly it can be to try to, you know, quantify one movie over another. Cause like, I'm going to give a list of like honorable mentions here, and there really isn't too much, you know, separating, say, number 8 from number 18 or something this year. It's ultimately just an exercise in wanting to discuss these movies and wanted to talk about the ones that meant the most to me, but I did think it was a particularly strong year. And I do want to sort of highlight my 11 through 20 on this list, because really, I could have been talking about these. And I actually went back and forth a lot between, you know, what I wanted to put towards the bottom half of my top 10, and then what, you know, just barely missed the cut. And part of it was just, what did I think that I had a little bit more to say about? What did I want to highlight to people who maybe hadn't seen it yet? You know, what did I think more listeners would have already seen, and what I just didn't want to repeat, like, received wisdom about. But I did think it was a particularly strong year, and there were a lot of really good films released that I enjoyed quite a bit. So why don't we just get right into that? Do you have any honorable mentions that you want to just say at the start of the pod that you enjoyed but didn't quite crack your list?
You know what? You mind if I hold till afterwards?
Yeah, of course.
I'm going to think about it while we're recording the pod.
Sure. Well, I'll do mine at the top and you can do yours at the end.
Cool.
That'll be kind of fun. But for me, the movies that I enjoyed a lot but did not quite make the list, I'm going to go in order of number 20 through number 11. So number 20 was Megalopolis by Francis Ford Coppola. Number 19 was Queer by Luca Guadagnino. Number 18 was Trap, M. Night Shyamalan. 17, Anora, Sean Baker. 16, A Different Man, Aaron Schimberg. 15, Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World, Radu Jude. 14, this one really surprised me. I didn't think this guy would be anywhere near my list, was Here by Robert Zemeckis.
You were surprised that Robert Zemeckis was there?
I honestly was. If you had told me at the start of the year that Robert Zemeckis would have even approached this list, I would have been pretty surprised. I haven't really connected with any of his movies in a long time before this one. But I did enjoy Here. I thought it was a pretty daring formal experiment. And for a while, it was on the list. But eventually, I just decided there were a few things that I preferred a little bit more. So I did want to mention it, though. And that's why it is one of my honorable mentions.
Nice.
13, Rap World, Connor O'Malley. Talked about this one on the pod with Brody and our friend Molly just a couple weeks ago. 12 was Juror Number 2 by Clint Eastwood, and 11 was Christmas Eve in Miller's Point by Tyler Taormina, I believe is how you pronounce that. So whether it be because we already discussed these on the pod, we talked about two or three of them already, or just because I had a little bit more to say about some of the other ones that actually did make the list, I decided to leave those off. But in most years, I think, you know, they could have potentially been on there, and I highly recommend anyone who has not seen them yet to go do so. So I guess without further ado, Tony, we will get into our list now. What was your number 10 for the year in 2024?
Yeah, so my number 10 was called The Comeback, the story of the 2004 Boston Red Sox.
Boo.
It was by this guy, Colin Barnicle. I was kind of, before seeing the film, I was a little bit apprehensive because we do live in this society of content-driven documentaries and things churning out so quickly, you don't really have time to process. The subjects don't have time to process. The audience doesn't have time to process. And so you're really kind of left flat a lot of the times. And so much of these are just glorified ads or just PR campaigns for the subjects. So documentary's in a really weird spot now, but I do have four in my top 10 list, I think. So that's pretty cool. Anyways, And the other point of apprehension was that there have been a few documentaries and, of course, like a World Series DVD. It's a well-trod mythical team, obviously, that broke an 86-year World Series curse. So that's why I was apprehensive about it. But this documentary gave a lot of cool wrinkles that I didn't know or didn't remember or knew about but didn't waste a lot of mental faculties on. And so I'll kind of talk about that a little bit. It's a three-part documentary. The first part is 2003 and the whole rivalry with the Red Sox and Yankees in 2003, culminating with Aaron Boone hitting a Game 7 walk-off extra innings home run off of Tim Wakefield. That's the first part. The second part of the documentary is basically the off-season and the season of 2004. And that was kind of when this whole rivalry reached this fever pitch that may never happen again. And some of the wrinkles that I found fascinating was one, Terry Francona. So if those of you don't know, Grady Little was the manager of the Red Sox in 2003. He famously didn't pull Pedro Martinez out of a game when he was completely gassed, but Pedro's a competitor, and should have pulled him out of the game in Game 7 of the 2003 ALCS. And so Grady Little, the Red Sox manager, was fired and replaced by Terry Francona, who, Nolan, is he a legendary Hall of Fame manager, would you say?
I'd say he has to be.
That's just a fan of baseball. Me too. And he won two World Series with the Red Sox, 04 and 07. Legendary run with the low-budget Cleveland Guardians, including a World Series trip against the Cubs, losing that in Game 7. But if you look at that 2016 playoff run, Terry Francona, absolutely iconic managerial performance, especially to me in 2016. It was kind of like the high leverage situation of relievers using. I mean, it was crazy. It was scary, the arms that he had and the way he deployed the pitchers. We're getting into a baseball podcast here. Anyways, Terry Francona.
We're already a baseball podcast.
Yeah, so I feel okay going on this tangent. Anyways, in this documentary, Terry Francona's just like, I had no idea what I was doing. Because before he managed the Red Sox, he had an unsuccessful stint with the Phillies. And so it kind of talked about that, but he also managed the Birmingham Barons, the AA Chicago White Sox. So he was Michael Jordan's manager in the 90s. So
I forget that all the time. Such an interesting tidbit.
It's such an interesting tidbit about Francona and the fact that, you know, he had to deal with a lot of personalities, which, you know, managing Michael Jordan helped him a lot. And his failed experiences in Philadelphia helped him a lot. He was kind of thrown into a team with a lot of big egos and personalities, including an emerging Hall of Fame talent, David Ortiz, who he was trying to find playing time for, which is insane when you think about it. And he ends up, you know, sticking with Ortiz, and he becomes an everyday player. But it was kind of a little bit on the fence there between 03 and 04, and Ortiz is like, hey, I really need to start playing. Nomar completely checked out, angry because we wanted to sign A-Rod, and it gets into all of that in part two. And so I didn't know how upset Nomar was. I kind of did, but he was really pissed, and he didn't even participate in this doc. And Kevin Millar went on ESPN and was like, hell yeah, I want A-Rod as my shortstop, which is crazy when you think about. Anyways, I'm going on. It's a really great underdog story, and it also gets into Tim Wakefield, who passed away of brain cancer. And so I'll always love Tim Wakefield forever. He's the consummate human and professional human being, like everything you want and what you think a good Red Sox player is. Like, even if Tim Wakefield was on the Yankees, he would probably represent everything that you think would be great about the Yankees. But he was a Red Sox player, and so just like completely invested in the community. He has this tragic event happen with the Aaron Boone home run, though I don't think it was his fault. Knuckleballs are better off low in the strike zone, and when they're hanging up by the letters, a T-ball hitter, including Aaron Boone, is going to take him yard.
That sounds like it was his fault.
No, I don't think you can control the knuckleball too much. Oh, I don't think you have as much control of a knuckleball as you think. So if you don't have it, like, you can tell watching a Wakefield start if he has it that day or not. But also the point is, he can just, because he throws a knuckleball, he can just eat innings for people. And so he did a lot of that in 03 and 04. But when it was up by the letters, I knew it was going to be gone. So you live and die by the knuckleball, and that's what we did. Great documentary, great underdog story. All loved Tim Wakefield. That's my number 10.
Rest in peace, Tim Wakefield, first of all. Tragic loss of him. He should still be with us. Really sad for his family. And fuck Curt Schilling. Just going to take the time to say that. I think that's necessary to any discussion of the 2004 Red Sox. That guy is a massive sack of shit.
For sure. And actually, so agreed 100%. 100%. He is a subject in the documentary. And
as he kind of has to be.
Yeah. The director actually sought permission from other players to be like, should I ask Curt Schilling? Just because the situation right now with him and the 04, with Schilling and the 04 team is not in a good spot based on his selfish actions. But they gave the director the green light. I will say Curt Schilling, despicable human being, and like a lot of other players who aren't very good humans, can still talk baseball. And if they keep it to baseball, you can still learn things about the game. Sure. It's kind of like how it is. You can listen to Pete Rose talk about baseball for 4 or 5 hours. Another guy who just kicked the bucket, but like...
rest in piss to Pete Rose. Yeah. Fuck that guy.
But hey, he can talk hitting till the cows come home, you know? So it's just whatever you're looking for. So, but yeah, no, I got to say again, emphasis on... Tim Wakefield plays a huge part in this, which I'm so glad, because he's also one of those underrated Red Sox players who just was totally selfless. And so many people had so many insanely nice things to say when he passed. He would do charity work with people, and some random development or marketing person for the charity who he like worked with would be like, oh, Tim, I'm like leaving the nonprofit for another one. And he like would record a video and be like, thanks, man, for like working. You meant so much to this nonprofit. And he's just like, why is Tim Wakefield like, this isn't in the doc, but Tim Wakefield is just so nice and generous to every human being, and he plays a good part. And then just to wrap this all up, I think what's great about why I would say it's worth watching, even if you're not a Red Sox fan, is that it's a great underdog story, and there's actually been time and distance to really let things marinate. It came out 20 years later, just like The Last Dance, which came out about 24 years later after the Chicago Bulls run. So I do think time is super important, and that's what I'm really interested in now as a cinephile, because we sort of live in this rapid content doc-driven era right now, and it's making people a lot of money because it doesn't cost money to make, and they're not very good. They're very trash, so...
Yeah, I was going to say, when I remember hearing about this documentary coming out, I remember being like, haven't we made this 6 times already? Hasn't Bill Simmons in particular made this like 3 times already?
I know, yes. Yeah. So there is Four Nights in October, which I think is a good doc. It's, that one's only 42 minutes, under an hour.
That's a 30 for 30.
It's a 30 yeah. for 30, and it's the first season of 30 for 30, and Bill Simmons directed that one. And so, you know, I think this is a lot... I don't want to say it's better than 4 Days in October, but if you were to watch 4 Nights in October, you can kind of technically look at it, and it kind of lays... It wasn't the first one released, but it was made in the first batch of 30 for 30s. It's one of those examples of, like, a blueprint for what the 30 for 30 docs are.
Got it.
You know what I mean?
Okay. So. Well, I guess I will then get into my number 10 of the year. The inclusion of this one is actually kind of why I'm happy that we waited a little while to do this, because I just watched this one a couple weeks ago, and it has really, really stuck with me. And had we done this right at the start of the year, I would not have seen it yet. So I'm very happy that I'm able to include Red Rooms by Pascal Planté. Maybe Plant, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his last name, but regardless of the pronunciation, he made an incredible film.
Maybe it's Planté, because like the goalie... Or is it Jacques Plante? No, it's Plante.
Plante. Okay, Pascal yeah. Plante. That's probably yeah. correct. This is the only film that I need about the true crime media fad and the gullible listeners who fall into the obsessive fandoms that emerge from it.
Nice, and I'm really glad that you're bringing this up right now, as I was just kind of talking about the state of doc content,
yeah,
true crime.
Oh, yeah. That, I think, is one of the most sinister, like, implications, fallouts that that whole thing can have, is when you make exploitative content about people who were brutally killed and, you know, highlight murderers and essentially turn them into celebrities. That can create a very anti-social culture that is just, we don't need to see that anywhere. And this movie has a lot to say about that, and I think it does so in a very pointed and intelligent way. This is actually the third year in a row that a French language courtroom drama has made my top 10 after Saint-Omer in 2022 and last year with Anatomy of a Fall.
Hey!
This one is French-Canadian, but I'm going to count it anyway.
Close enough.
Yeah. This is a much more chilling film than either of those two are. It acts as more of a horror movie, actually, and has stuck with me even longer than those did. This movie is about a woman, Kelly Ann, who is a internet model, basically makes money showing up for these gigs, going out playing pickleball in her spare time, and then she lives in an apartment with these very high-tech devices in her home, which she's jailbroken or set up in a way to be able to very efficiently stalk and find out information about high profile victims, particularly in a especially grisly murder trial, which most of this film centers around, in which a man is on trial for brutally murdering three young teenage girls in an unspeakable fashion. And worse, he recorded and live streamed the act for paying customers to watch online in anonymous corners of the dark web. And at the trial, Kellyanne, who is in attendance, she is not a member of the jury, she is just sort of a bystander. She meets another person in the same circumstance, Clementine, who is an obsessed woman who is adamant that the man on trial is innocent and has been giving public interviews explaining why he should be released, much to the disgust of the families of the three young girls who were murdered. Clementine attaches herself to Kellyanne, and Kellyanne invites Clementine into her home, despite it being quite obvious that Clementine is misguided and a bit obnoxious, you know, very gullible, sort of has read what she has seen in the media and internalized it and is not quite sure, you know, how to accurately process that information. This movie, it opens with a very long take inside the courtroom, these very white walls. The trial is just beginning. We see the defendant escorted in, and the prosecuting attorney outlines for the jury and the audience alike exactly what happened, how it happened, and what they should expect to see and hear moving forward. It's made clear that videos of the murders still exist, and two of the three are already in the hands of the court. But crucially, you never actually see them. You see characters reacting to the videos. At one point, Kellyanne, who is in possession of one of these videos, sort of scandalously shows one of them to a horrified and overwhelmed Clementine, which goes a long way towards changing her mind and sort of helping her see exactly what has happened and the role that she has played in this and how destructive it ultimately is. But also, when the videos are played in the courtroom, we hear the screams of one of the victims, and we see a stretcher brought into the courtroom to assist somebody who passed out upon seeing it. And the way that the film withholds this information and leaves it up to the viewer's imagination is really disturbing and really executed flawlessly and makes for a truly horrifying viewing experience that really sticks in your mind for longer than most horror films. And as the plot develops, we learn more about the trial, more about Kellyanne and the rabbit hole that she goes down because of it. The film develops this overwhelming feeling of sinister dread and the pervasive influence of unchecked evil as she's revealing herself and is in contact with these, I don't even know if you can call them characters because we never actually see these people. It's just left for you to assume what their role is and, you know, what role they played in the deaths of these girls and the live streaming of their murder to a paying audience of sick freaks. The mere fact of their existence is enough to send a chill down your spine, like I think a lot of internet horror can do when it's done correctly. And it leads to some images in this film, particularly in the third act, that are uncanny and mystifying. interesting, even in terms of the character's motivations, even when it's a character like Kellyanne, who we've spent so much time with in the film, and particularly someone who, if she's not mentally sound, like, she at least knows her way around society and knows her way around, you know, making logical decisions and finding ways to receive the information that she wants to receive. I really just can't get it out of my head. And it tackles subject matter that is so dark, I think it would scare most directors away. And so Pascal Plante does a fantastic job of presenting it in such a matter-of-fact way that it feels calculated and empathetic without ever really being exploitative or letting the viewer turn away from the unspeakable evil being depicted. At the same time, the film is also a very sharp character study that, in a way, implicates all of us who have spent the past few years scrolling through social media timelines where memes and viral TikToks are mixed in with news of mass shootings, reactions to whichever serial killer Ryan Murphy is making a Netflix series about, and videos of children being dismembered by bombs. I think it has a lot to say, and it's a movie that I'm going to think about for a long time.
Woo! I missed out on that one.
I think you'd like it.
I was looking, it played in September at the IFC Center. As much as I try to see all these movies, sometimes they fly under your radar. So.
Yeah, it's such a dark movie. It daunted me a little bit to even watch it. Like I said, it was just a couple weeks ago that I finally sat down and was like, well, shit, I guess it's time to watch Red Rooms. And it really left a mark on me, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. If enjoyed is even the right word to use. I mean, it horrified me more than it, you know, made me think, oh, wow, this is such a good movie. But sometimes that's what the best films do, and this is one that sticks in your craw. So if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. What's your number nine?
All right, my number nine is another documentary. It's Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat by Johan Grimomprez. This film, in our last episode, I talked about this wonderful documentary by Alan Kassanda called Colette and Justin.
Yes.
Which is about his grandparents growing up in Belgian-colonized Congo. Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat is also a documentary dealing with a similar subject, directed by a Belgian filmmaker who's going after Belgium, the United States, and the West for their actions in the assassination and overthrowing of democratically elected Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba. It's very heavy, detail-oriented, and why it's called Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat is because as the coup is happening, there's also sort of this global presence, and especially in the continent of Africa, of jazz music. And you see the United States, the CIA, using some of the great black jazz musicians as cover for their actions. And I want to be clear that I don't think that the film implicates these jazz musicians. So you have Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, Nina Simone, Duke Ellington, John Coltrane. The whole film is sort of soundtracked by their music, and I don't think it implicates them. I think it's very clear who the blame is on, and that's the Belgian and United States governments and deep states. Through this film, you can see how these Western entities operate to get what they want. So yeah, Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat.
I have not seen that one quite yet. I do have a website where I tend to watch movies that I can't access otherwise without paying up the ass for, and this one I did see was just added to that recently, so if I can't go out and catch a screening of it in a theater, I will certainly have to check that one out, because it's definitely piqued my interest. I'm glad it made your list.
It's still in cinemas, though.
Oh, okay.
So it's still in cinemas, and with the jazz score, the surround sound speakers.
Ooh.
And it's 3 hours, so it might be a little tough watch at home, but it was just nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Film, so it may be coming to a city or town near you. For those of you outside of the city, for those in the city, it's still currently playing at Film Forum as we speak.
Hell yeah, man. I will have to go out and see that one myself. Again, for the people at home, that title is Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat. Number 9 for me. This one is a little bit shorter. This is probably the only non-feature film on my list, if that's what you want to call it. It's kind of in that gray area, though. But it is from a director who has made some truly electric feature films in his career, and who is one that I will turn out to see anything he makes. It is It's Not Me by Leo Carrà. And part of the reason that this has made my list is... holy shit, it's a successful Godard pastiche. That's like impossible to do, but he somehow pulled it off. This is Leo Carrà's 40-minute visual essay in which he stitches together some new images from himself, some footage from his past films, footage from other people's films, with sort of the perfect balance of irony and sincerity that he has mastered over his career. For those of you who saw Annette, I think a lot of that same sort of stylish humor is included here. You actually do see baby Annette herself in a very fun post-credit scene, but not here to talk about that. This is a work in progress, as Carrà himself states at the very start, and much like cinema itself in the midst of a century that feels like it's rapidly evolving and falling apart at the seams all at once. I mean, he's sort of asking questions about the art form itself and its effect on the world, its effect on him and on us as cinephiles. And, you know, sometimes he takes sort of a tongue-in-cheek approach to some of the questions that he's asking and the concepts that he's chewing on, but it never really feels disingenuous or misguided in any way. You know, it feels very earnest, even if he's trying to be funny for quite a bit of the runtime. And I will say this as well. When Leo Carrà wants to be funny, it's often a bit more successful than when Jean-Luc Godard wanted to be funny. You know, he's one of my very favorite filmmakers ever, but a lot of his jokes were pretty stale and did not land. And Carrà makes me laugh with this one, as well as in a lot of his other films. I mean, again, I go back to Annette, which he just put out a couple of years ago. It's a very, very funny movie. So yeah, I mean, this is so visually and ideologically dense that I think talking about it can really only go so far. It was added to the Criterion Channel recently, and if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend watching it. It's kind of one of those things where, you know, words only go so far.
Wait, what's it called?
It's Not Me.
It's Not Me. Mm-hmm. I knew that, but hold on, because I've been trying to find it on the Criterion Channel, and I can't.
Oh, no, it should be right up there.
Are you sure?
Yeah, that's where I watched it.
Hold on, listeners. I'm going to quickly see if I can find this, because I've been having difficulty finding it. What is your favorite Leos Carax movie?
I would say it's definitely Holy Motors. I love Holy Motors. That's a banger. That's just one of the best.
It's called It's Not Me?
It's Not Me, yeah.
Dude, I've been trying to watch it like every week and it like hasn't come up. There it is.
There it
what
is.
What the fuck?
Check it out, man.
I have to. That one I missed. I did seek out, and for some reason, did it go away after its premiere?
It did, yeah. It didn't really air too much in theaters.
It had a Criterion Collection premiere, which I missed. It was like a live stream or a live broadcast.
They just added it right to the channel after they did that.
Maybe I went the next day and tried to look for it, and it wasn't there.
Oh.
It was. Huh. I didn't know what happened, but I'm glad to know it's there now.
Yeah, check it out.
Wow. You know what? I'm going to pivot. We're going to live pivot, because I'm just going to talk about movies. Yeah, I'm going to go with number 9. Wait, is this number 8?
Number 8.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Furiosa, a Mad Max saga.
Ooh, okay. I didn't see this.
This was the sequel to George Miller's Mad Max Fury Road, and it did not do well at the box office. Critically, it did well. For some reason, people didn't show up for it. Which is strange.
Guilty.
I kind of blame the marketing team for this one. Actually, guilty here too, because I saw an Academy screening of it, so I didn't pay. It was for free. I didn't support it at the box office either. I'm going to place the blame on the marketing team for this film because everything in the trailer indicated that it was just Mad Max Fury Road again. It was all, at least in the trailer and commercials and poster design, everything was like Fury Road again. So everyone's like, didn't this movie just come out? But it's not like that. If you watch a Mad Max movie, people are always going to go on the Fury Road. People are always going to go on the road, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's exclusive to the road. Fury Road was more exclusive to the road than Beyond Thunderdome, The Road Warrior, and Mad Max. So I thought it was, again, one of the great action movies of the last decade or so. It's strange saying that in some ways because I might have liked this more than Fury Road. Did you like Fury Road?
Loved it.
You loved it. I think George Miller, again, is just one of the, with his Mad Max films, is one of the great action filmmakers of all time. And we just don't make action movies. Hollywood doesn't make action movies the way they used to, and I don't know why. Again, George Miller in Furiosa lays out the possibilities of what can be done in the action genre. And I just want to shout out Alila Brown. I think that's how you pronounce their name.
Seems like it.
She played young Imperator Furiosa, so she plays the young version of the Anya Taylor-Joy character, who was the Charlize Theron character in Fury Road. Alila Brown, unbelievable performance. She carries the first half of the movie on her shoulders, and it was riveting stuff.
I kind of had an interesting path with Mad Max Fury Road. I didn't see it in theaters when it came out. You know, it was at a point in my life where I was much younger and I wasn't really, you know, as much of a movie guy. So I wasn't showing up to the cinema as much in 2015, I think, is when that one came out.
Right.
But it was kind of right around the time when I was just starting to get into that lifestyle. So I did see it with my family at home when it came out on digital.
Mm.
The first time I watched it, I didn't really understand it. I didn't really know what I was seeing. I didn't hold as much like appreciation for some of the effects and some of the things that George Miller was doing with the camera and some of the incredible set pieces they have in that. And then a couple years later, actually, two of my really good friends in college decided to watch it together, and I actually skipped it because it was the same time that I was first discovering the movies of David Lynch, to kind of make this a little bit timely.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching Mulholland Drive for the first time. And so I was going through a religious experience with that, and I was so enraptured by what David Lynch was doing. It was right after I watched Twin Peaks for the first time, so it was like, okay, I got to get more into this world. I first discovered him in like 2017, sort of dating myself with that. But so I missed that rewatch, but I remember being like, yeah, I need to give Fury Road another shot. And then probably like 2 or 3 years after that, I did go back and I watched Fury Road again. And that time, everything clicked and I loved it. And I realized what he was doing and really how impressive it was. Honestly, I don't have much good reason for not having gone out to the theater and watching Furiosa, or for even watching it in the many months after.
You know what, Nolan? Not many people have a good reason for it. I don't know why. And that's why I kind of blame the marketing team on this.
I was just like, I just skipped it. I don't really know why.
And I hate to throw someone under the bus, but I really think they were just trying to be like, Fury Road again.
Yeah.
And no one wants to see that. You know what I mean? You just have to sell how this is going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I agree.
And of course, you go on the road, as you do in every Mad Max film, right? There's been 5 of them.
I don't know. I did the same thing with Nosferatu last month. I didn't go see that one either, and I haven't watched it since it's dropped on digital. And I did that for the last Robert Eggers movie, too. I didn't go see The Northman when that one was in theaters, which is kind of strange because I did an internship in L.A. in 2019, and when I was out there, I saw The Lighthouse when that was released, and that was one of the most fun experiences I've like ever had in a movie theater. Like, I love The Lighthouse, not particularly particularly huge on the Northman. Like, I think it's fine. I have the same sort of thoughts about The Witch. I'm getting a little bored with Robert Eggers' whole deal, like, that he has no interest in making a contemporary movie at all because he doesn't want to photograph a car, I think is a little lame.
Has he said that?
Yeah, he said that, like, even this week, I think it was in an interview. But
was this an IndieWire interview?
I might have been. I'm not sure. But it's kind of like, well, what do you have to say about the world that we currently live in? And I don't know. That might not be a particularly fair critique, but it's just sort of to say, disclaimer, I did make my list without having seen Furiosa, without having seen Nosferatu. So didn't get to absolutely everything, but I will go on with my next movie here. And my number 8 is Challengers.
Wow.
Luca Guadagnino. One of two.
How about that tennis ball, huh?
How about it? It sure is a thing. One of two movies on my list that was also one of the most popular mainstream movies of last year. I think you could probably make the argument that more people saw Challengers than any other movie to come out last year. Also one of two movies directed by Luca Guadagnino to release in 2024. I mentioned Queer was, I made my top 20, did not make the top 10. I do think that that has some of the best moments of his career in it, particularly the Come As You Are, Nirvana, Needle Drop, and the long shot of Daniel Craig sitting in his room shooting heroin. Just pure cinema, you know? I mean, really, most of the first hour of Queer, I think, is really, really strong stuff. I think it drops out a little bit towards the end, but, you know, I digress. That's why that movie didn't make the list and this one did. My favorite of his two 2024 releases was Challengers, his love triangle tennis movie starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. This is just so entertaining. Keeps the energy at a 10 from start to finish. It's full of twists and turns, but the MVPs for me are Zendaya, who I had not been super impressed with as an actress until I saw this movie. The jury was a little bit out on her just from a personal standpoint, but I think this one utilizes her very well and does a good job of showing off her strengths as an actress and really lets her thrive, as well as Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who composed the electrifying score that fits perfectly with some of the rapid-fire editing of the tennis matches themselves, as well as Luca Guadagnino's daring formal experiments, like making the point of view of the camera be included into the tennis ball itself as they hit it back and forth, and using slow motion towards the very end as we're approaching the climax of the movie to turn every facial expression into a plot twist, and every drop of sweat into, like, its own event. This was probably, like I said, the most popular movie of 2024, so not exactly alerting the people to something they likely haven't already seen.
Trust your gut, man.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Who cares if it's the most popular film?
No, not at all.
Or number one at the box office.
Not at all. Just, you know, one of the things that
a good movie is a good movie.
You're damn right. One of the things that I kind of put into this list is I'm thinking, you know, if there's, like, a tiebreaker between two things, and, you know, one is something that's a little bit lesser known, something I could give some exposure to, I would like to do that. But ultimately, this movie is just so good, I didn't want to leave it off. I think really fun movie. It's the only one of these that I saw twice in theaters during its original run, so, you know, whatever that means to you. If that, I think it's just an endlessly, like, rewatchable movie. It's an immediate entry into the canon of sports movies, and the three central relationships each shine in their own way, and the push and pull between them is really something extraordinary. And yeah, I think Luca Guadagnino had a very strong 2024 between this movie and Queer. Did you see it?
I did. I saw it at Williamsburg Cinema, and the theater went wild, dude. Some good experiences.
Yeah.
And a great audience experience. I do recommend Williamsburg Cinema if you want that, like, younger 20s crowd who may not be 100% hardcore cinephiles, but they get out and see films and care about the culture, care about awards films, things like that, just to be part of the discourse. Williamsburg Cinema is a great spot for that, for people in their 20s and 30s.
Absolutely. What's your number 7?
All right, my number 7 is The Seed of the Sacred Fig by Mohammad Rasalouf out of Iran. It's a just under 3-hour thriller family thriller, and it is about a man named Iman, and he has worked his entire life to rise up in the revolutionary court system in Iran, and he has just gotten promoted to a high-ranking position. He is a husband and father of two daughters who are high school, college age, so right around, you know, between like 15 and 18 years old-ish. And this narrative takes place during the 2022-2023 protests and civil unrest against the police force, where a Iranian woman named Mahsa Amini was murdered by Iranian police for not wearing a hijab. So, do you remember that? Happened like 2 years ago.
I vaguely remember it.
So, this is happening, but the father is part of the Revolutionary Court, and he's basically given an order for his wife and his daughters to not partake in anything, chill for the sake of our job, and because of this, we're going to get an increase in salary, we're going to get a better home for ourselves, more room, more space. So, the film is critical of the Iranian government. On a surface level, that's cool. I think that's why a lot of people liked this film and gravitated for it. But to me, what was fascinating about the film and what aspect of the film I think relates to everyone or could relate to everyone is this idea of a person giving themselves and working themselves all the way up the ladder in a job where possibly you become one with your job, and then you realize that all of a sudden, maybe you're a bad person with your job, and you're the bad guy, but you think the entire time that you're good. And there are a lot of different jobs where that could be. It could be a police officer, it could be someone in the military, it could be a health insurance executive, it could be Wall Street. Maybe some people are good, or they're bad, but these are, you know, society jobs that definitely have a lot going for them in the positive direction. There's a lot of positive propaganda with these different positions, as there is, I'm sure, in the country of Iran. So what happens when you kind of become one with your job and then you realize, uh-oh, maybe I'm the bad guy? And how do you mentally respond to that? And how we see Iman respond to that, I think, is a fascinating character study and the draw for this film for me, or a big draw to it.
I haven't seen this one yet, but I think it's really fascinating, some of the stuff that you're talking about there with some of these, like, attaching yourself to your job and, like, sort of stepping back and seeing your place in the world and, like, how it is impacting the world and the people around you, and sort of the, like, introspective questions that can raise. Because I have a movie that's a little bit later on my list. I think you'll know which one I'm talking about when I get to it. Mm-hmm. That deals in very similar subject matter, and it's by one of my favorite directors working right now. So, yeah, I mean, it's just very interesting that, like, we both have a film on our list that's sort of asking these questions and doing so in a way that really, like, immerses the viewer within it and sort of has, like, them saying, you know, what would you do? What would I do if I were in this
position? Right, exactly.
Position?
Totally. And it's this weird thing, especially in America, too. I think boomers have said this. They've taught their children this. Millennials and Gen Zers, they'll have this classic phrase where they say, if you do what you love, you'll never have to work a day in your life. But the danger to that is that you kind of become that job. And any critique of that job from outside becomes to some people, an attack on you, you know? So it's just like you work in a nonprofit, but then someone critiques the nonprofit industrial complex. And then that person who works in the nonprofit thinks that you think that they're a bad person or something like that, or can't even mentally wrap their head around honest critiques of what they may be involved with in their job. Right. So, yeah.
It's fascinating stuff.
So, on like this is on a completely different scale in the Seat of the Sacred Fig, but, you know, like a base example I gave for you right there.
Yeah. Number 7 for me, this is a big one, The Brutalist, Brady Corbet. The trailer for this movie uses one word, monumental. Critics everywhere used it to describe The Brutalist, a 3.5-hour odyssey complete with an overture and a 15-minute intermission. Wound up being like 25 minutes for me because the theater, I think, forgot to start the intermission for like 10 minutes.
Oh, no, that was me too.
Oh, yeah.
Did
you
see it at the AMC?
Yeah.
Lincoln Square?
Oh, did they do that on purpose?
I think so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, I think they may have done that on purpose because I went out, went to the bathroom, came back, and there was like 18 minutes left, and I was like, sick.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the bathroom disparity between men and women has never been more noticeable in my life. It was truly kind of comical. I went out, I was just like, you know what? I'll hold it. I will wait.
Come on, ladies. Yeah. Support male auteurs.
Yeah. Yeah, this is...
In stunning VistaVision.
Yeah, damn right. This is a movie starring Adrian Brody as Laszlo Toth, a mid-century architect who flees Nazi persecution in World War II-era Hungary and winds up in America, where he lands in the orbit of Harrison Lee Van Buren, portrayed by the great Guy Pearce. Harrison Lee Van Buren is a proud capitalist, proud entrepreneur and philanthropist who takes more pride in being the one to embark on grand adventures than he does in actually achieving something real and helping people in a tangible way. In his occupation, his demeanor, his appearance, he may as well be a direct descendant of Daniel Plainview. And I think that's very fitting because Brady Corbet, as a director, is positioning himself as a direct descendant of Paul Thomas Anderson, particularly PTA between the years of 2007 and 2012, as There Will Be Blood and The Master are clearly heavy influences on this movie. Given the runtime of this film, its ambitious array of characters, themes, locations, the use of VistaVision, I think this is an explicit attempt on Corbet's part to establish himself within the canon, and I would say it's mostly successful. The first half of this movie is phenomenal, as the opening finds Laszlo Toth and a boat full of immigrants ecstatic as they land in New York City for the first time and they see the Statue of Liberty. He begins staying with his cousin, who has all but renounced his Judaism already, down to the accent, and his American wife, and even his name, where they meet Harrison Lee Van Buren's son, Harry, played by Joe Alwyn, who I think gives one of the better performances in this film, you know, is just this piggish, crass, rich kid asshole who shows up and enlists the two of them to construct a redesign of his father's library, which upon seeing Guy Pearce goes ballistic, kicks them out, and given a portion of damage that they accidentally caused to the house, Joe Alwyn says, "We're not going to pay." A falling out between Toth and his cousin finds Toth working a low-end job where Van Buren once again approaches him, stating how much he's grown to appreciate the work that Toth did and that he would like for Toth to return back to his home for a much greater project. And as Toth is tasked with building this massive community center that ends up taking like decades to complete, he tells the powerful Americans in the room about his wife and niece who are still attempting to flee Hungary. That's Elizabeth, played by Felicity Jones, and Zsófia, played by Raffi Cassidy, who, if you can remember, gave a really great performance in Brady Corbet's last film, Vox Lux, which came out all the way back in 2018 because it took him a good like 7 years to complete The Brutalist. And in the second half of the film, Elizabeth and Zsófia arrive in America along with Laszlo, and further complications arise. The second half becomes much more sinister, confrontational, perhaps even allegorical, And by the end, we have a story being celebrated by others that isn't quite accurate and doesn't quite belong to Toth himself. And there are plenty of different ways to read the last 40 minutes or so of the film. And while I do enjoy the fact that it's sort of open to interpretation, I think how you choose to see the ending and the filmmaker's intent behind it is entirely influential on my ultimate enjoyment of it and how successful I believe it to be. You know, I have my own personal thoughts on it, which is ultimately why it cracked my top 10 list. I think it is a very smart movie, but at the same time, if you choose to read it even a touch differently, that can also sort of fall apart. I think that that's interesting, you know? What's not up for debate, though, is the fact that audiences turned out for this 3.5-hour movie made for adults, and the screening I went to seemed to be like 80% young people, so the fact that there's still a sizable audience for something like this is a great sign. I will say, though, at the end of the movie, I did kind of find myself a little bit relieved that there still is only one Paul Thomas Anderson. Did you see The Brutalist?
I saw The Brutalist, yeah. I want to agree with you that I found that the audience as well was fairly young. And I do think still the way to box office success is not through IP, but through a director and actor-driven work. I think that's what the success of Barbenheimer was. None of this PR manufactured Glick nonsense. Nothing against either Gladiator 2 or Wicked, but I think no one actually used that phrase except the celebrities on their PR
tours. I didn't even know what you were referencing.
No, exactly. No, totally. Yeah, I, the crescendo, I should say, to the intermission was some absolutely thrilling cinema. And I also want to shout out, it's just a little bit of a spoiler. Turn this off if you don't want to hear the intermission spoiler, but when it ends with the photo of a family, someone on Twitter, I don't know who did, who it was, and I can't find it again, did the letter. Is his wife, is it his wife's letter?
Yeah.
Did the wife's letter, and then at the end of it, put the entire Costco guy's family universe. And I just like fucking died laughing.
Five big booms for The Brutalist.
Five big booms for The Boom. Brutalist. Five Boom. Big booms for The Brutalist Boom. Joke with the Costco Boom. Family.
Boom.
And then I logged off the internet and said, that's enough internet for today.
Yeah, that's a good way to end it. What's number six for you?
All right, number six for me is Aggrodrift.
Ooh.
Harmony Korine's venture into video game technology and cinema. So a lot of people lately have been very angry at Harmony Korine. And someone yelled at me for putting this on the list. And I don't know why. I have been following his career. The first film I saw was Trash Humpers, and I've been seeing all of his new releases since then, and then, of course, have gone back. He's a guy who's constantly evolving, very much in the spirit of the French New Wave and German New Wave, of constantly thinking about ways to up the ante or change the game or explore the possibilities of cinema. And I think that's really admirable. Also, he's been given the reputation as a Le Enfant Terrible, which is, for those of you who don't know, basically a provocateur, someone who could make good films but decides to thumb their nose at society. But I think that kind of enfant terrible reputation brings a serious edge in a perception to him. And I actually think at the heart of Harmony Korine's films is comedy and vaudeville, and particularly the Marx Brothers and silent film stars like Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton. I think that is at the heart of it, and not in a bad way, but I think people are searching for extremely deep meaning and understanding with Harmony Korine's films, and then get really upset if they can't find any deeper understanding. And I thought this film was so funny. And I also think it was a great job sort of doing two things. Another thing Harmony's great with is experimenting between content and form. And I thought he did a wonderful job saying, okay, what can we learn from video games and apply it to the form of cinema, right? So that's part one. And then part two of his experimentation is video games the new cinema? And, you know, part of me is like, no, it's not.
Part of me is like that, too.
People say that video games is the new cinema, it might as well be, but it's just like there are moments in Aggro Drift where it gets really leans into video games, and you're like, video games do be like that though. Like the narration, the monologues, the filler lines, it's like a lot of this movie is when you go into, I'm not the biggest video game guy, but I know when you go into the world of a video game and you see a random person who's not really part of the plot line and you hit the button X to speak to them and you hear what they have to say, you can then just walk away and they'll keep talking. And they're just saying mindless stuff. It's just filler, I guess, you know?
Literal NPCs.
Right. That's the term. See, I don't have the video game vocabulary to, like, say NPCs. Yeah, so it's just like, okay, but, like, what if half the cast is NPCs? And in cinema, you can't walk away from the character until the director cuts away from them, you know, because the director's in charge. That was fascinating because you were given these wonderful moments where you see the beauty and the wonder and excitement that you can take from video games and apply to cinema, and also know that video games on the surface level ain't cinema. They're two different mediums, but that's okay. We can learn a lot and take from each other. And I see that a lot in this film. And then, like I said, it's laugh out loud funny. It is comedy from beginning to end. It is about an assassin named Bo, who's trying to kill a crime lord. You got Travis Scott as this character Zion in one of the more outrageous conversations about the Bible and maybe Rome, and it's a total NPC moment and you're just stuck there for 10 minutes. And again, like the inner monologuings of Bo are straight out of video game narratives, and how very, I don't know what the correct word here is, vapid they can be. Like, it's vapid, but it's contributing to a greater experience of playing the video game.
Right.
And his lines, the vapidness plays into comedy and the experience of watching the film play out. A lot of video game movement and repetition as well. Infrared digital photography. So yeah, I give this a 10 out of 10.
Okay.
Aggro Drift, check it out. You can see it on their website, edgelore.com. I saw it twice in theaters, and the first time I was there, it was awesome. I sat next to a dude who was in the film itself.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we were at Nighthawk in Williamsburg, because that's where they were playing it, only at midnight. And there was a certain part in the movie, he called a waitress over from Nighthawk and ordered a beer, held his finger up, told her to wait for a sec, and she did. And then he pointed at the screen and was like, that's me. I'm in this movie. And he was so stoked, and his homie was stoked too. So,
well, good for that guy.
Yeah.
I missed this one because whenever I like was looking up showtimes to go see it, it seemed like it was only being shown in these very, like, either, you know, like you said, midnight screenings or like limited capacities.
Strip clubs.
Yeah, basically where it would cost like $50 to get in. And I'm like, this movie is 80 minutes long. I'm not paying $50 for that. That's fucking crazy. But now that it's more widely accessible, I think I'm definitely going to go have to check that one out. That's very, very high praise. Number six for me, I anticipate this being the one in which you and I are the farthest off. This is the other kind of major mainstream release on my list. It's Dune Part 2. By Denis Villeneuve.
Why do you think we're far off?
Because you fell asleep in the theater for this one, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, no. Have I been outed?
Yeah, a little bit.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I snoozed through this one. Sorry.
Sorry, Denis Villeneuve.
Please forgive me. I can't do Dune. Because people say how awful David Lynch's Dune is, which I don't know if that's correct or not.
It's pretty correct.
But if it's pretty correct,
I say that as the biggest Lynch fan,
I might be into it more than I am these Dunes. But I would say it's not the filmmaker or the actors. I think it's the subject that I just can't quite get into. But okay, that's credit fine. To everybody else who does.
Yeah. I did an episode on this one like right after its release with my friend Eric Nielsen. So if you want my deeper, longer thoughts on that, go check out that episode. I might try to link it in the description. I have a couple more films a little bit later on this list that we already talked about, either I did or you and I did together, so I'll try to put links to those all in the description. But yeah, we talked about this one in depth already. I considered leaving this off again just because, you know, one, already talked about it, and two, it doesn't need any more exposure. Everybody saw Dune Part 2 already. But I just can't deny that it was one of the most exciting experiences that I had in a movie theater last year. And really, this is my ideal of what a successful Hollywood franchise blockbuster should look like. You know, there are so many movies that have been released even in the past like 5 years that fit that description and just wind up being ugly, phoned-in slop. And I don't think that Denis Villeneuve has ever really been guilty of that. And he really bent a lot of studio directors over with this one. The second of, I think it's going to be 3 Dune films that he's making, adapted from Frank Herbert's sci-fi series, starring Timothy Chalamet as Paul Atreides, and featuring an absurdly stacked cast consisting of Zendaya, Josh Brolin, Florence Pugh, Christopher Walken, Rebecca Ferguson, Javier Bardem, Austin Butler, Lea Seydoux, Dave Bautista, Stellan Skarsgård, Charlotte Rampling, the list goes on.
Are you serious? Or are you making that up?
No, I'm serious. That's literally the cast.
I'm sorry, I went. I just
yeah, no, you slept through it. You probably missed the Austin Butler scene.
I saw the floating guys in the beginning with the jetpacks.
Oh, I love the floating guys.
That was a nice concept.
If you name an actor who's been especially popular this decade in the 2020s thus far, chances are they are in this movie. And I think it's kind of funny to bring up Zendaya, because how I said that I felt about her performance in Challengers is sort of how I felt about Timothy Chalamet in this movie. Like, I already liked him as an actor. You know, he had impressed me in a bunch of movies already. Lady Bird, Call Me By Your Name, Little Women, what have you. But I was more sold on him than I was on her, I think, going into this. And in particular, you know, that rallying cry that he gives towards the end of the movie, which again, you might have slept through, that really convinced me that he has a lot more range than I previously thought. And his performances this year, both as Paul Atreides and later as Bob Dylan, both really impressed me. Everything that you would expect from a big sci-fi blockbuster is really turned up to a 10 here. Set pieces are incredible. You can't look away from the action sequences. And, you know, I think a lot of how this will ultimately be received in the long run will be dependent on the third part of the trilogy, you know, both like ideologically, because there kind of are a lot of like up in the air questions about this one, or like depictions of certain things that you don't really know how to read quite yet. So Dune Messiah, I think, will probably be the title of the third one. I think we'll provide a lot of clarity into that. But I also
finally we're gonna get some clarity.
But I also kind of mean that in sort of like a Game of Thrones type way, where it's like, you know, that show dominated all of culture for years, and then the ending was so shitty that it's like it doesn't even exist now. And like, yeah, I mean, it's possible that if they totally botch the ending of Dune, like that could wind up happening here. But I mean, given everything that I've seen from Denis Villeneuve, like, I like all of his movies that I've seen, I think. I don't think I've ever really disliked one. Like, Prisoners, Enemy, Blade Runner, 2049, Sicario, you know. Even if I don't love everything about those, I mean, the direction is phenomenal. Like, he really knows his way around a camera. He knows how to entertain an audience. And I expect him to stick the landing. I think he has set himself up very nicely to complete something very exciting. That's about all I have to say about this one. Again, if you want further thoughts, check out the Dune Part 2 episode I did with my friend Eric back in like April. So
yeah, I think it's a talented director and talented people. I will say, I just want to say, even though Dune isn't really my thing, I want to recommend the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune. Have you seen that, Nolan?
I have not seen that one.
It's a wonderful documentary. You can, real quick, pep talk, PSA, if you have the means, please, a film isn't available on your streaming service, but it is available to rent, just go for it. Rent it. If you have the means, it's a few bucks. You can see Jodorowsky's Dune, which is a documentary about the unmade Dune version by Alejandro Jodorowsky, which then kind of the storyboard, famous iconic storyboard of a film that wasn't made, kind of made its way through the Hollywood black market of sorts and influenced decades worth of science fiction, adventure, and fantasy films. I recommend it. It's a lot of fun. If you like Dune, if you don't like Dune, it's great either way. You can see it on Amazon Prime, and it looks like it's $3.59 to rent.
Just from sort of peeking over at your computer, it looks like Jodorowsky's Dune is available on the Internet Archive, so you might not even have to rent this one.
You might not even have to rent this. That's actually like, stunning that it's there.
Sometimes like renting stuff can be great. It supports a filmmaker, but he's dead, so you're not doing him any favors.
Wait, who's dead?
Isn't he dead?
No, Jodorowsky's
still alive. Oh,
yeah.
Never mind. He's not dead.
Jodorowsky's still alive. He didn't direct this documentary. He's the subject. The guy's name's Frank Pavich.
Oh, okay.
Jodorowsky.
Is he really still alive?
Still alive. He's like 97,
maybe? Oh, my God.
95.
Oh, my bad. My mistake. I think that was a fair assumption.
Yeah, but
you know.
I definitely recommend Jodorowsky's Dune as supplemental material for all Dune heads, Hollywood gossip people, pop culture folks. It's a good time. I saw it in college.
And I apologize to Alejandro Jodorowsky himself for assuming he was dead.
Who is not dead.
Not
exactly.
Dead. Very notably not dead.
That's going to do it for us on this episode. You just heard us discuss some of our favorite movies released over the past year, but you haven't yet gotten to our top five. And for that, you'll have to wait just a few more days. Part two of this episode will be released on Friday, so if you're listening a few days from now, it may be out already, and in that case, you don't have to wait at all. I'd like to just quickly take the opportunity to tell you all about the Mudville Patreon, which you can find at patreon.com/mudville. It is the easiest way to access all of our content, whether that be the main feed, in which Brody Staub and I discuss baseball and cinema, or episodes like this one, where Tony Brown and I discuss some deeper and more obscure cuts on Mudville at the Movies, as well as a new release here or there as well. You can also find writing on Major League Baseball, the New York Yankees, lists, and previews. All of my prospect rankings are available at that site. Just this week, I'll be putting out my list of fantasy baseball dynasty rankings for first-year player drafts, in which I discuss draft picks from last summer, as well as a few international guys who just signed contracts with teams this week. It's a great way to learn more about players who will make up the future of baseball, and it's free to sign up to receive emails anytime we put out new content. We really appreciate any support you're able to give to the show. If you're not able to sign up, that's okay. We would appreciate a 5-star rating and review right here on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you happen to be listening. It does truly make a difference, and you help us be able to continue doing what it is we love to do. I truly hope you enjoyed the first half of this conversation Tony and I had about our favorite movies of the year. We're signing off now, and we'll see you on later in the week. To be continued.